from the Australian Herpetoculture Podcast. How you going, buddy?
Who are you?
I know. Who are you, stranger?
I remember you from somewhere.
I know. Months ago.
Years, even?
Yeah, probably. We did one. We did one at the start of the year.
Oh, yeah, we did too.
Yeah.
I mean, we did, like, what, three last year or something, and we came pretty close to the Reptile Fight Club guys still that were doing them weekly, so in the ratings.
No, sorry, we've had lots of messages from people to start it back up, get going again. We've just been busy with life, unfortunately. Yeah,
kids take a lot more time than I thought.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. So, yeah, sorry, everybody, about being a little bit MIA, but, Jason and I are hopefully going to pick up this ball and maybe not weekly, but maybe fortnightly or something like that, or we'll try to aim for fortnightly episodes and we'll just start back at that sort of regime. But we do have a few guests kind of in the pipeline to hopefully come on and have a bit of a talk so you guys don't just have to suffer through us. But should we introduce tonight's guest?
Yeah, let's do it.
So tonight we have Michaela from Max Frog Army on with us tonight to talk everything amphibian and more. Hello, Michaela. Hey. How are you?
Hi, guys. How are we tonight?
Good, good.
Very Thanks happy to have on. You on as our first frog-keeping guest, first female guest.
Yeah.
You're ticking a lot of firsts here.
Yeah. Setting records.
Say hi to everyone as well, so.
Yeah, well, yeah. Thanks so much for coming on tonight. Yeah. Why don't you just jump straight in and introduce yourself, and you know maybe what got you started in animal keeping, and just give us a little bit of history about yourself.
Okay. So firstly, the Max Frog Army came about for my son because I told him about how the collective for frogs is an army, which he thought was pretty cool because we're a 12-year-old boy who plays Call of Duty, and it's Mum's Frog Army. I'm like, well, that sounds a bit funky for Facebook, so we'll go with my name, Mac. That's how the Facebook page started. But frogs for me, growing up in the Hawkesbury, we had small acreage, 5 acres, and used to be an old piggery. So, those concrete old laundry tubs.
Yeah, yep.
I had them as waters in every single yard. And our job as kids was to go along with the hose and make sure every single one was topped up because there'd be tadpoles in there every day of summer. So we'd put our little sticks in to keep so they could all come out and make sure they had food, and we'd chuck in lettuce and that sort of stuff and grass because, we were kids and we didn't know any better. So we raised frogs constantly on the property, and we'd be out hunting the tadpoles and, trying to beat the red bellies to the frogs. And it wasn't a worry. We just wanted the frogs, the family, we had every animal imaginable. We've had goats, horses, dogs, chooks, birds, the lot, bred, showed the lot. And, I took a little bit of time out to gallivant around off overseas and horse riding and showing dogs and marriage, babies, divorce, that sort of thing. Moved back to Australia and went, right, now it's my turn. And started with my first group of parents, and now I'm the crazy frog lady. So, I love them. They're such incredible species. They all agree, obviously.
Can you hear them?
They've started. All the species, tree frogs especially, but I love all of them. So,
they're definitely going to give us some ambience tonight.
Yeah. They know you're talking about them.
Yeah. Mostly Richard, the parents, Mags, green trees. Oh, hang on. Oh, no, it's Dainty's red eyes trying to join in. there's Blue Mountains.
They're all kicking off now.
That's so crazy just to hear so many species in one spot.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And they're all in my house. So
Yeah, that's just crazy.
Why I live where I do. I live out in the middle of absolute nowhere, in a pretty cold region, so everything's inside, which is how, because I want to be surrounded by them. So bedrooms, my son's, office, playroom sort of, he's got frogs. The entire bottom room of the house that used to be a veranda, that's got all the racks, dining tables, you know, for 10. They're in the lounge room. Yeah. I mean, they share the space. I've got a bunch of other reptiles, so, but the frogs kind of get, they get the best spots.
Priority.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because we were both obviously at the Illawarra Expo not too long ago, and I didn't know, I knew Karen Russell was there with her mags, but I didn't actually know you were there, and I was kicking myself because I was going, I would have loved to have seen so many varieties because you have so many species currently available that aren't commonly seen in New South Wales available. And yeah, it would have been great to have a chat to you there. But now we've started kind of chatting, and I'm just going, man, you have, what was it, close to 20 species of frog now?
Yeah, we've counted at about 18.
18, yeah.
With more species sort of this year coming. So, and that's not even counting the reptiles. So, but yeah, 18 frog species, predominantly tree frog species.
Yeah.
I do have, probably four. What have I got? Stripies, spotteds, banjos. Histoni creeks are still technically a tree frog. So I've got three ground species so far. The rest are tree species. Anything arboreal I love, like most of my geckos. Mm. But the tree frogs are just incredible. So,
yeah, I think they're some of my favourites as well.
And yeah, they're fun.
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And to build their enclosures, you know, the bioactive, you know, you can plant, yeah, to your heart's content, and they'll be up in the leaves and you can see them basking. There's a couple of ground species I'd like the ornate burrowing frogs, but, you know, you're kind of looking at, you know, sand. So, <Yeah. laughs> you know, they're not really going to come out much. So just the marsh frogs do at night, and the banjo frogs, they all come out. They're pretty cool, but you don't see hide nor hair during the day. They just burrow. They're gone. So It's not get out with the head torch at night and go, you know, you have some crickets and are you all still alive? So.
Well, do you want to give us a bit of a rundown on the species that you currently have and, you know, include your reptiles in there too? Because, I mean, this is actually generally a reptile podcast, but, you know, we're happy to get some amphibians on.
Yeah. Well, I'll start with the reptiles because there's less of those. So I've got, you know, the usual, I've got a couple of beardies, a couple of blue tongues. I've got my Aki who, since I got a monitor, that's going to be a close love to my frogs. I can see
some trades happening here.
I was just about to say something along those lines, to be honest. I was like, oh, an Aki's cool, but I know something better.
That Aki, he is just, oof, I love him. Since getting him and I've got a pair probably coming as well, and he's amazing. He's actually very happy at the moment because I had to chuck in another 6-foot rack because I was obviously running out of room, and he can look down onto, I've got the grow out tank for the Stony Creeks down there. So they can't see him, but he just sits there watching his frog TV. He thinks it's great. I'm like, yeah, that's why you don't ever come out. So I've got him. I've got a few geckos. So my fimbriel, my first geckos, absolutely adore them. They're just the coolest looking geckos. I love that they can climb upside down and that sort of stuff. I've recently gotten some broadies and some leaf tails. So,
oh, cool.
They're fantastic. Oh, so pretty. Love them. Then, you know, your angles, your boids, anything rainforesty, love it. I got one snake and now I have three snakes. they're all marble children's pythons. So there'll probably be more of those as well because they're just awesome. But I'm just trying to think if that's it for reptiles. Yep, no, that's it for reptiles. So then the frogs, well, my first frogs were parents. So they are just highly underrated. They have the best party pants in the world, those bright black and yellow legs and under their armpits and everything. Yep. And the call, I love it. It just sounds like someone's laughing in the background. So my first frog, I got four of those because we don't just get one frog in this house. So And then I made a connection with someone on Facebook, and, you know, she was going to be moving in a state, and she had this big, beautiful, you know, 90 centimetre by 90 centimetre Exoterra and the frogs in it and everything. And I was like, yep, yeah, I'm going to get them. They were in Mount Gambier. So I drove down to Mount Gambier and picked up 6 green tree frogs in an Exoterra tank.
Oh, wow.
And went home again. Yep. And then from there, it was just, there was nothing done by halves. I went from, in the space of 2 years, I went from like no species to this.
Wow. That's an amazing feat in itself, because yeah. I was just saying to Jace, I was just before, you know, when you're fixing up your mic and everything, I was like, I struggled for years to get to like 7 or 8 species. So I think it was like 7 at the time. And you just kind of came through and whipped up nearly 20.
All of them.
Because some of them are so hard to find.
So it's taking me a little while, and yeah. just making the connections with frog people is a little difficult.
They're not quite as out there as the reptile people. No. They kind of keep to themselves a lot.
Problem in New South Wales is with our licensing, with no, you know, we're not allowed to advertise that they're, you know, so it's a lot more sort of secret society here. You know, there's secret handshakes and that sort of thing. But I've connected with a couple of interstate breeders, a couple here, you know, like, you know, Karen's awesome. I've got 8 of her mags because they're just, her mags are pretty cool. But, yeah, so connecting with a few helped open up the doors to finding some other species and a few trades. And once you sort of had a couple of extras, then you're like, oh, I've got this and maybe we could get this later, and just all the wheeling and dealing. And, yeah, here we are. So the red eyes are another firm favourite. They're just so pretty.
Yeah.
And, again, I'm quite into – look, I've got a lot of species you can't do any, you know, just for display, you know, your tiny little phallics. My whistling, they're pretty good. They're not actually that shy, but they're obviously the smaller species you don't handle. Yeah. But some of your bigger ones you can, but I pretty much anything that can tong feed, like your perrins, the white lips, they calm down so much with tong feeding. Same with the perrins, because juvenile perrins and white lips are pretty feral. you know, you walk past the tank and it's just ballistic missiles going everywhere. Once they get a little bigger and you can start tong feeding them, just totally different frogs. My red eyes will tong feed, the parents, the white lips. Even my little dainties, some of those will tong feed. They're so cute. They are very dainty, actually. The name suits them really well. They don't do anything. There's no thumps coming out of their tank. They don't ever try and, you know, eat each other when they're trying to get crickets. They're very gentlemanly, the dainties.
Yeah.
Not like, you know, your green tree frogs that if it moves, it's food. So, you know, sometimes they'll go running out in the middle of the night because you'll hear this god-awful shrieking because one of the mags or the green trees or someone's tried to, you know, missed a cricket and grabbed a leg instead, and you're trying to wrestle frogs apart and screaming like cats. It's like, wait, what's going on? So, yeah, the species that are a bit nicer to each other, you know, your red eyes, your dainties, I really enjoy having those.
Yeah.
So the stream frogs, they're beautiful. You know, your Satropa, your Blue Mountains, your Philocroa, Green Stream, the Stony Creeks, the males in breeding season or out of breeding season because they think it's time now, the males go bright yellow.
Yeah.
Which is just, you know, you come out with a torch and you see them and it's just so pretty, this bright yellow little speck on one of the Stony Creek girls can get pretty round. So there's tiny little yellow dots sitting on the girl, and they can get a bright electric blue on the inside of their legs too. So
oh, then cool.
So people go, oh, yeah, it's just a brown frog. But they have some cool stuff. Even the little brown frogs are pretty interesting. So who else? Whistling, I think. They've got not quite party pants like the perrins, but they can get the black dots on the groin with the yellow around it. So they're a little, I think they're a bit better than the southern browns. I think they're a bit more interesting. the call's nicer. And they're just so cute. They're just little and they'll poke their heads out from between the plants during the day and they just watch you. So yeah. There's two little following you. So there's still a lot of enjoyment in the little brown frogs as well. So, but
yeah. I don't think a lot of people will appreciate all the small stuff in our, like, we've got so many small frogs over here.
But you just, low. Yeah.
Yeah. You just don't see any love for them. Even just right down to, like, you know, your common eastern froglets. Like, I know they're common as hell, hence the name, but, you know, they're such little interesting frogs to watch at night.
Oh, they are. And because I've got them. I've got three. And, yeah, you don't see them much, but I can look at them at night and they're out and they're walking around and they're fast. I've got them wild here in, oh, there'd be thousands. You walk outside if it's raining here and you've got to be careful where you're walking because it's, I've got common eastern and the sign bearing for crinia. I've got spotted marsh, perrins, tons of whistling, a lot of the green phase whistling here because we're at like nearly 900 metres.
Yeah.
So it's probably a little bit more the alpine version. Pobble chunks, the banjo frogs.
Yeah.
So, but the little crinias here, they're tiny little things and they're just fun to watch. The same with the phallets. Some people, you know, don't really know what to do with them because they're not always green and they're little, but I have them in a group. You've just got to watch with the phallets. They can be bullies.
Okay.
They, like, the little frogs, they could be mean. So you got to give them plenty of plants so that everyone's got space to get out of the way. What else the little frogs have I got?
You said you got bicolour as well?
Yeah, I was able to get some bicolour. They're surprisingly quite a bit of difference from the phallics. I mean, they're a little bit bigger. I find they're a bit pointier and longer in the face and the head as well. Their calls are similar and they will set each other off. And they've got more of a copper sheen to them. I've got three that are sort of half green, half copper sort of colour, and they get a real metallic shine to them. And they love to bask. They will be out under that heat light on their reeds pretty much all day. I think there's only one that, if you walk up near the tank, like a little dart frog, you'll sort of like do this shuffle and he'll go around to the back of the, you know, 5 mil wide reed thinking he can hide and that's him safe. But the others are just all sitting out right as close to the basking light as they can get and that's where they'll sit all day. So they're pretty to watch as well.
Yeah, they're a good little frog. Just very, very bouncy. That's the one thing that I found with those little tiny guys like that. It was, you know, every time I was opening doors, it would be like a bit of roulette because you weren't sure if I was about to,
Like open one, keep one closed.
I had to do a bit of a trim in the phallics the other day and I didn't do a lot because I was like, I need to probably just move you guys into a new tank if I want to do anything with your current tank. These tiny little missiles, you can't always see them. For a little while last year, I'd had a male phallics jump out straight over past my shoulder and I've got a whole lot of big plastic tubs for growing out plants. So there'll be, I think there was about three tubs and he lived his best life for like 3 months, could not catch him. he'd call, you know, there was always water in the tubs. There's, you know, as we all know, there's 10 million crickets running around loose. So he was fat as a fool. And he was like, why should I have to go and share an enclosure? He was happy as anything. And eventually I sent my son in with his headlamp and went, right, you need to go catch this frog. like months later we managed to get him, but he was so tiny and they're so incredibly fast. If I have to do anything with the phallics or the bicolour, it's best that I have a spotter. I usually have my son come behind me so that if I miss one, he can tell me if something's jumped out. But it's always nerve-wracking opening the door to the little tiny fast frogs.
I kind of almost after owning those, I was like, okay, I think like a 35 to 40 mil frog is like my smallest now. Like that's as small as I could go just because those little guys, like I think I lost one within the first week. It just shot over my shoulder, never to be seen again. Yep. I was like, he's not surviving in this garage. And then ever since then, it was just like so nerve-wracking even feeding them. But beautiful to watch. But, yeah.
And they're just very fast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm always – oh, when I'm catching the little baby ones, like to put in their little travel cups for the expo, usually I've been known to go and take like the little tank into the bathroom and I put all the bugs in, I put towels under the door, over the drains, and then I'll start. And I'll have someone in with me as well. It's usually my poor mother. She gets called over for frog spotting duty. And, yeah, because trying to catch, you know, juvenile phallics when they're, you know, a centimetre long and crazy, faster than anything. Yeah, we do it in the bathroom with, yeah, towels over drains, yeah, everything. God. Just they terrify me that I'd lose them, so.
The crazy thing is like I actually do that with like baby monitors. I'll put the plug in the bath and I open up like the incubation tub in the bath so that if they scatter everywhere, they're just stuck in the bath. But frogs obviously can stick to things and bounce off them, whereas like my lizards are stuck.
The amount of times I've had, because, I mean, my bathtub's quite deep and we're trying to bend out and they'll, but even the little phallics and they'll be trying to, they're hopping their way up the sides and mum's trying to put the cup over one to hold it and I'm trying to hold one in the other one. It's absolute chaos with those little tiny frogs.
So. I could imagine.
But that's good to know with, the baby monitors because I haven't bred the monitors yet, but I was kind of like, right, so how do you get them out?
Because, me personally, I don't like, I like to get them out of the incubation tub and then put them in like a larger container with some moist paper towel and then back into the incubator for a few days. So for like that transfer in particular, I just find that so much easier and less stressful to open them in the bathtub or in like a big plastic container or something just to, you know, they're there. But yeah. Oh, okay, well, while we've kind of, I think we've got a pretty good rough knowledge of what you're actually keeping now. Do you want to kind of like run us through maybe like some of your preferred keeping methods? Like, are you more of a sterile keeper? Do you like naturalistic, bioactive?
I am bioactive all the way. My first tank ever went straight to bioactive. I didn't even think there was another option. and a little while, probably about, 6 or 7 months or so into my frog keeping journey, and I got they were rescue frogs, but I paid for them just because they were in a really, really bad situation. And I got 7 green tree frogs, horrific bacterial infections. It was terrible. So straight to the vets, x-rays for, you know, to check for MBD, which a couple of them did have, and everyone's like, right, got to go into a hospital tank, bare glass, this, that. So I tried that. And how anyone can keep that clean is beyond me. It was constant. It was, and they weren't getting better, you know, all the vet treatment, the antibiotics, everything. I'm like, you know what, bugger this. They're going into a bioactive. If I have to throw it all out, doesn't worry me, but they can't be healthy in this glass. And move them over and that was the first we finally started to make a dent on the bacterial infections, the lethargy, these really, really sick frogs. And, you know, weeks later you wouldn't know there was anything wrong with them. And that then was – and this is why I go bioactive. So even my quarantines, I'll just make it up in a smaller tank and if I have to toss everything in there, that's part of – that doesn't worry me. So and just – the frogs are instantly, they're just happier. You know, they've got plants to hide under. There's cleanup crew. I don't have to worry about, you know, the springtails eat frog poo from, you know, the entire time. You don't see it. It's just so much cleaner. So I couldn't have this number without doing bioactive.
It's a lot more aesthetic too. Like you walk into the room and you see your tank set up nice. You've got the frogs in there. Like it's almost like nature.
It's like a little jungle in here. I've got and you've got all your lights on, you walk in and there's greens and all different shades of green and the lights on reminds you of sunshine. It's just a happy feeling walking into a full frog room with just plants everywhere. Frogs are happy and they're out basking. It's got to be nicer for them. Yeah. So, I mean, to look at, but for them, and they're in this tiny little, no matter what size tank, I mean, I try and give bigger tanks, but they're still in a glass box. Mm. So it's up to us that we need to provide, you know, as much, enrichment, but environment for them. You know, they're used to soil. It gives you better microclimates, you know, if they want to get under the leaf litter, or there's a dark spot with a hollow log, or giving them those kind of options that they would have out in the wild, I think is the best life for them.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, do you have a preferred tank that you use for your tanks, or you just whatever you kind of at the moment, whatever you can get kind of thing?
I love my Exoterra tanks.
Yeah.
I mostly have those. I've got one little rack, a 90-centimetre rack, that I've got one 90-centimetre tank and two others because they're the odd tanks out. So I've got them shoved in a corner so that they don't muck up the rest of my my nice Exoterra tank. I do have a couple that were made by the reptile zoo in Canberra, just because they're waterfall. They've got the water feature sort of built in, and I grabbed them secondhand off Facebook, which is where I get my tanks.
The best spot to get Exoterra is to.
If I could have every single tank as an Exoterra, I wish they'd make something bigger than the 90 centimetre, though.
Yeah, definitely.
That's the only problem. I've got one. It might be a Reptizoo. It's a 1.2 by about almost 100 centimetres high, and it's one of the big, it's the older one, so it's like 60 centimetres deep.
Yeah.
If I could find, and it's, I got it for free because it's, cracked panel of glass here and cracked at the bottom and that sort of stuff. So that's going to be a forest dragon tank. But if I could find some bigger ones like that, and if Exoterra made a bigger one, that'd be it. Every single tank here would be Exoterra.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was my thing with the Exoterras was, and the depth wasn't deep enough, like the 45 deep. If they did a 600 deep, it'd be so much better.
Perfect. And also, I mean, I've got a couple of the Paludarium style ones, so you've got a much higher, the doors are a lot higher, so you can fit better water sections in. But they're awkward to get into, and you pretty much do have to have quite a bit of water in them. I've got pretty much everything's like the 45 by 60 high. I've got a 45 cubes for grow out tanks, like for the phallux, for some of the smaller ones, like the whistling, the phallux, that sort of thing. Anything else. I don't think a tree frog should be in anything lower than 60 centimetres because you just can't get the lighting right.
Yeah.
Because I'm a bit of a lighting nerd, I guess you could say. When I first got my parents and I bought them from a place that, you know, pretty much on paper should be reptile specialists. And they sold me a mercury vapor bulb for frogs.
Oh, no.
And, you know, I'm in a reptile-specific place and they sold that and I went, okay, and I took it home and I went, hang on a minute, this, I'm looking at the box going, I don't know enough about this, so I jumped on and jumped on the internet and I found the reptile lighting group. And from there it was just straight down the rabbit hole. So I've got my own solar meter, and that is the best thing I ever bought. So because when I'm building tanks, I can check UVB levels, so I know where to put my branches or my ledges. So that's helped me build the tanks as well. But the lighting, being a mercury vapor bulb for frogs, like, fuck, yeah. does my head in. So,
Did you kind of like string together that this wasn't the right globe before using it?
Yep. I was looking at it and I got home with it and I'm looking at the box and I'm just like, this is
a. It's got like a bearded dragon and a tortoise on there or something.
Desert.
What? And I'm like, this is huge. This can't, I don't understand. Oh. I'm not thinking in, I need to understand what this is. And then I got online and it went in the bin. Like, I wasn't taking it back because I wasn't stepping foot back in the store. So I was that cranky. And, yeah, it just went straight in the bin. And that started my journey into figuring out the very complicated lighting that's available. So.
Yeah.
So What kind of lighting are you into now? Like, what's your preferred sort of methods to keep your guys happy and healthy?
So everything gets either an Arcadia UVB in their appropriate percentage. I also have some of the Lumeds Reptisun tubes because they're exactly the same. Same factory. So some of the frog tanks, the smaller frog tanks, I use the Shade Dwellers. Which are the, I use the 7% because I can position it so that they can't get directly underneath it. But generally I just use the 6% forest because I have the UVB meter, so I can position it so they're not, they're still getting the correct UVI for their Ferguson zone. So, and the same with all the reptiles, you know, my dragons and the ackies have the 14% in the Arcadia or the 10 in the Reptisun. But yeah, every single animal has UVB. So
yeah. Where did you get your UV meter from?
I got it directly from the Australian office of Solar Meter, which is up in Queensland. Yep. Express posted it. I had it within 2 days.
Yeah. Excellent. Oh, yeah. Gosh. I think a lot more people should invest in those. The price of those have come down heaps.
Best thing. I've helped a few people in Canberra that bought animals and setups from that original reptile place that I bought the frogs from and the UV and the MVB bowl. And I've actually gone over to people's places with the solar meter and helped them, you know, with baby beardies that, you know, aren't eating and, you know, aren't basking and that sort of thing because they've been sold the wrong lighting and equipment and everything. Because I drive around so much for work and I say, look, just I'll come over, we'll whack the solar meter under it, we'll see if you're getting enough UVB, we can play, you know, play with things. And I enjoy doing that because I know that, you know, not everybody, people that have got one bit of dragon aren't going to go and buy a solar meter.
Yeah.
But I think they should, but I understand that it's not, you know, in everyone's budget. But anyone who keeps, you know, not even half of what I have, they're the best thing out. I have saved so much money. I have Arcadia tubes that are still at, oh, they'd be 16 to 18 months old, and I kind of wish they would drop in output because I'd planned to recycle the tubes down through the species that need less. You know, so my 14% could go down through the blue tongues, could go down through some geckos, frogs, whatever. And the bloody things, they won't drop their output yet. So I'm having to buy more tubes. but I'm not having, they're not being replaced. I don't recommend for people to run them that long unless they can check them.
Yeah,
definitely. You know, they do recommend at 12 months, but I don't have a single one yet. And I've got some nearly up to 2 years that they're still outputting the correct UVI for that species. So,
With that being said, how long are you running a UV for daily?
12 hours in winter and 14 hours in summer.
Okay.
So you just follow the sun up.
Actually, I do probably eventually get them down to about 10 hours because I try and even the frogs benefit from, they don't need quite the same cooling as some of the reptiles, but you do need to let them have a cool down period for their health. So, you know, running, you know, same with your reptiles, but your frogs, you know, you run them a green tree frog at 30 degrees year round, you're going to shorten their lifespan.
Yeah.
Yep. And do need a bit of a more natural cycle. So, but yeah, summer, 14 hours UV of light. So they're not, and, you know, sometimes if we get a power outage or I'm playing around with tanks and forget to plug timers back in, that sort of thing, I'll be passed out on the sofa and wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning and go, holy shit, sorry, guys, it's nighttime now. You know, so sometimes they run a little bit more than they're supposed to. I test them regularly. I'll just go around with the solar meter and just run around all my reflectors. I put a little label on of what month and year that they were purchased, just so I keep an eye on it. I'll just run around with the solar meter around my 50-something enclosures that I might have counted today.
Don't count. You never count.
No, that's right.
Well, I just
that's an error.
I just
if someone asked you, just say lots.
my log keeper, I put my my login for my, you know, your online keeping, because that had to be submitted this month. And I really appreciate that that online system doesn't tally everything for you. List all your species, so you only have to scroll down a little bit to count them all.
Yeah.
But they don't give you, there's not like a, it's not like an Excel spreadsheet where you can tally it all up and there's a big number just staring at you at the bottom of the screen. So you can live in denial quite easily. But no, I just run around, check every single one with a solar meter. The newer ones, anything under 12 months, I'll probably only check once or twice. But yeah, anything once we get sort of over the 12 months, probably maybe once a fortnight or once a month if I forget to do it every fortnight, because you can't obviously tell, the brightness doesn't change.
That's right.
Yeah, so you can't tell by looking at it. So I'll just run the, you know, open door, hold up the solar meter. I check either end and in the middle just to make sure that, you know, the range is there, and yeah, don't have to worry about it. So.
So that's the other thing too. You invest the money in the meter, you're saving money on tubes.
Oh, not having
you to know, replace like
everything. I have to replace 50-odd T5 tubes a
every year.
Year.
Yeah. You know? If you're getting, you know, a year and a half, 2 years out of some, like, you know. And like you said, then you cycle them down through the other ones, you can see what the readings are. So
yeah, that's right. Because, I mean, I've got, you know, I do have quite a few of the stronger ones, like for the Beardies and the Aki and that sort of thing. And yeah, if I can cycle them down, I've, in the beginning, I got each T5 to suit the tank size and that sort of thing. Now we're at the, we buy the, you know, what is it, the 54 watt T5, the long one, and it just goes over a bunch of tanks. So,
yeah.
You know, it's over 345 exoteras on my tadpole and juvenile raising racks really well. So, and then I just use the meter to check where, you know, branches, plants, that sort of thing go, so that they get the right amount. And yeah, that's saved a few cords. That's the other thing, PowerPoints cords. That's always our strength. So, but yeah, so that's why I like all the tanks to be matching, because then my lights sit on them properly.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
you don't have that kind of like a little bit of a difference in between tanks and things are kind of
right, and that drives me crazy. So and with the bioactive, obviously I use plant grow lights, and in the beginning I'm like, oh, jungle dons, these things are great. And then my tank numbers got up and tank numbers got up, and the bank balance doesn't keep going up. So
and they're expensive.
Buying jungle dons wasn't the easy, you know, wasn't doable. So those downlights, Luke and I were chatting about it, the Arlet downlights at Bunnings, oh, best things ever. I love them. Plants are growing well. They still throw off a little bit of heat. I've got some of the, for a while there, Bunnings was going to discontinue the 7-watt ones, or 6 or 7 watts, some of the smaller ones. So I remember like a bunch of Bunnings in Canberra and just bought up. Four Bunnings. I was like, yeah. And then I was in there only a couple of weeks ago and I went to get some more. I'm like, oh, bastards. So it was back up to normal price and the discontinued thing was gone. I'm like, oops, I bought too many.
Yeah. Well, they must be popular. You better stock them again.
That's it. So I'm like, oh. And then I looked over at the 9-watt ones, which were slightly wider circumference, and they had a 2-pack. I'm like, oh, I'll grab some of those. So I've tried those and they're not a huge amount, you know, only a couple of watts, but they're a slightly bigger light. So I've used them on, you know, some of my 90-centimetre tanks. I've got some 4-foot tanks with frogs in them, that sort of thing. So, you know, they've got a couple of those chucked on. And one tank, the big 4-foot tank, it's got like the pothos, the devil's ivy and the dragon's tail. And it's taken off. It's going to have a haircut. So it loves them. It's growing really, really well. So, yeah, I'll just keep, at the moment, I'll keep buying those. So,
yeah.
Yeah, I had like a $400 fish tank light above my mag tank, and it was there for a while, and like it wasn't new to begin with, but it ended up burning out and kind of fizzled out. And I was like, I don't have money to replace this fancy light to put this above it. And I was going around my, like, you know, you got like an electrical box of just like random reptile crap you've stored up over the years. And I was like, oh, there's a handful of these small down lights. These will do for now. And I put them on and everything's actually, I think, doing better now that I've got those down lights on there. And I was like, this is like $30 worth of lighting on these three little tiny down lights versus this $400 light. Like, I'm sold.
Yep. I mean, look, if I won Lotto and could change everything over to the new Luminize from Arcadia, yes, I would get more Jungle Dawns. But that's going to – that's like a proper – that's like a Powerball win or something. That's not
you – know, yeah, they're not cheap.
So, but, yeah, the downlights, I'm really happy with them. I do remove those little clips off the side just so that they sit a little bit better. But, yeah, I've got them on a whole heap of tanks now and people that – you know, because I promote the bioactive so much and a lot of people that buy frogs from me and I try and at first, you know, when I was still using the Jungle Dawns, I always said, look, I use these, but, you know, there's got to be cheaper options because the Jungle Dawns are pricey. But since I found the downlights, I've got a picture of the box and I send it. I went, right, go get some of these. And, yeah, plants will grow. Chuck that on with your UVB, heat light if you need, you know, nice little incandescent and you're set. That's all you need.
Yep.
So, yeah. I'm trying to – so I started on a care guide. You know, I'm selling these frogs and I'm coming from dog and horse breeding and showing over the years, I'm still in contact with people that bought puppies from me, you know, 8, 9 years ago. And I kind of do the same with the frogs. It's just on a larger scale. So I'm like, right, instead of all these poor people having to, you know, message me and that sort of thing, I'm going to do a guide. Well, it's kind of taken on a life of its own because – I'm going to do a basic one that's just like a card that I can give people with the expos. But then there's another one that's, you know, not far off being a damn book because every time I get into another section, I'm like, oh, no, we've got to add this and, you know, oh, but what about this? And, yeah, I don't know when it's going to be ready. So, but, yeah, so I'm sort of trying to add, you know, lights in there and what I can recommend people that aren't going to have a solar meter and, I'm just trying to make it a little bit more basic and a little less overwhelming for people coming into frogs.
Yeah.
There's so much scattered information online, you know, reptile specialist stores selling mercury vapor bulbs. There's a lot of dangerous information out there too. Same as the reptiles. You know, you jump on half those Facebook groups and you just, you know, yeah, it's a bit scary. And
especially frogs, someone new.
Oh, that's the thing with someone new. You can't – I don't think we should – a lot of people are really hard on new keepers. I think we're just scaring them away. You know, they go to a pet store, they buy what they're told and they think they're doing the right thing and then they come into these groups and they are slammed. And, A, all it does is they either get rid of the animal or they just don't come on looking for advice. Detrimental, you know, for both of them. So if I can do a little bit of a guide just some pretty basic but enough that, you know, the keeper's going to do the right thing, the animal's going to be happy and healthy for them, they can have a pretty bioactive enclosure. It just sets them up right because frogs are – the popularity is increasing a little bit as there's a bit more awareness of them.
Yeah.
They're also a great pet for, you know, apartments, kids with severe pet allergies. You know, so many kids now that and adults as well, but – you know, dogs, cats, anything with fur, and a frog's a little bit less confronting to parents that, you know, might not want their kid to bring home a snake, but it might be a gateway, like a gateway frog into having reptiles. So if you can make it a little bit easier for someone to be able to keep their first frog, then I think that's not just great for, you know, bringing more people in, but it's just getting it out there a little bit more. So. Yeah, I can have a pretty slice of a, you know, garden in their apartment with real plants and, you know, a little frog for the kids to look at that might not be able to have a pet. And also landlords tend to be happy about them because they're not a pet that comes out.
That's right. Yeah, they're not making a mess on the carpet.
And, no, it's, you know, not
doing all that stuff.
A fish tank that could spring a leak and ruin their carpets. Yeah. You know, you can most a lot of my frogs just have a water bowl. So these people, you know, new people can have this pretty tank, have plants in it, dresses it up, you know, if the property manager comes over and, oh, that's pretty, isn't it? You know, oh, it's a cute little frog and it's just sleeping during the day and, you know, it's very,
Until night.
Get a Richard and she wants to keep everyone at 3 a.m. But, you know, in those situations, I tell people either Stony Creek because they have the quietest call. Or look around and, you know, try and get something that's a little bit older that has been sexed and has been. Because so, otherwise you end up with, a chorus. So,
which sounds pretty good though.
Oh, look, it's awesome.
It sounds great until somebody complains.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you panic about it.
10 acres. Yeah. I can't see another house. The only thing I have to worry about is the sheep.
they're fine.
Yeah.
I still remember my first green tree frog, Yoda, and I had him for ages in the bedroom and we were convinced he was a female forever, and then one morning all of a sudden it must have just been like a rainstorm had come through or something, you know, the pressure drops, all the rest of it, and all of a sudden my wife wakes up and was like, I didn't know the neighbors had a dog. Oh, man, it's so loud. She was banging on the guy, and I was like, I knew exactly what it was. I was like, yeah, dog, yeah, that's it. She's like, it's like it's in this room. Yeah. I was like, oh, the next day I'm just like, I'm just going to move Yoda downstairs. This is going to keep up all summer. Yeah, no, they're good fun.
When that rain comes through and that pressure drops and they all start, They like it when it rains.
I think I did the same thing with some red eyes. I think I had I had six of them in this tank in the bedroom, and I think three or four of them ended up being male, and like all of a sudden they all just hit chorus one night and was like, holy moly. I was like, all right, yeah, these guys are going downstairs to the garage as well.
The red eyes and the dainties have surprisingly rough sort of calls for their looks.
Yeah.
Mm.
They're not it's not a pretty sound. The dainties even more so. They open them and you do not expect that sound to come out of that cute little body. But the red eyes are slightly better, but it's still not a pretty sort of song. And four red eye males going at the same time and they're all trying to outdo each other, they're going to get louder.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it was pretty painful. No, good frogs nonetheless, but, yeah, geez, they got the voice for it. So what sort of feeders do you use for most of your frogs? Obviously it's going to vary depending on the size of your frogs, but do you want to run through kind of like what your kind of average kind of days look like when you're feeding out to your animals?
Yeah, look, mostly crickets just because they're easy for sizes, but – I have, because I've got so many species and I need some in-between sizes, so I live half an hour from Cricket King, so
well, I can. That's good.
Weekly. So I keep my sizes right and that sort of thing. But I'll also try and grow out tubs, so I'll have in between, you know, a small and a medium for certain size froglets. I'll let some pinheads grow up a bit bigger because, you know, baby phallics might not quite be big enough for the tiny yet. So it's juggling the cricket sizes is a fair bit. Woodies all the time because that helps my cricket bill. And they thrive on neglect. They're fantastic. They're a great feeder. My small froglets, I use the little Komodo does a mealworm feeding dish. Yeah, it's probably about an inch or so, inch and a half, maybe 2 inches high. It's curved. Once there's a little bit of calcium powder on the smaller woodies, they can't climb out of that.
Okay.
So I pop that in with my froglets. If I've got a bigger grow-out tank with more, I'll do like a Pyrex bowl, chuck some flue on around the side, the edge, and I'll put a bowl in with tiny or small woodies for the baby frogs as well. Every single frog and reptile here, that obviously – eats bugs, they all get the woodies as well. The smaller frogs love, I hatch the fly pupae.
Yeah.
Probably up to about parent size. I don't flies for the big frogs because their aim is terrible. They would love to catch the flies, don't get me wrong. But they're going to hurt themselves. I've tried it, and they've just, especially the green tree frogs, they have no grace or coordination at all when they're trying to catch flies. And I'm just like, someone's going to give themselves a concussion. We just leave it alone. But sort of parents down, that sort of size, I'll chuck some fly pupae in a little dish, let them hatch, and they go nuts. They love it. And I'll also, in summer, because I live where I do, there's no chemicals used on the property, I'll catch moths as well, put them in, because A, enrichment, B, another food source, it's a bit different. I try and do silkworms in season, just because they're, pretty, quite nutritious. The frogs love them, and I can feed them because they're such a soft insect. I can feed the bigger ones to the smaller frogs. I don't have to worry about action or anything like that. I don't ever feed mealworms to any of the frogs. I just, there's not a lot in them. They're okay with the reptiles as a rotation, but I just don't feed them to the frogs at all. Mostly flies, crickets, woodies. Really want to hit Frizy up for some hoppers. I think some of the bigger frogs especially would love them, and so with the reptiles. I have messaged him before, and then, life got busy and he didn't have that size at the time, and I was going to come back and I didn't, and you know how it goes. So, I will write a note in my book and go, right, order some hoppers. So I'd like to try those for them. I'd really like to try and give as big a range as I can, just for, different nutrition and just something else to chase for them, partly enrichment. But the flies, and black soldier flies, I don't feed the larvae, but I will give them the flies.
So, okay, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
The larvae just doesn't get digested by the frogs. So I've tried, because anything that Tong feeds will eat them. But it comes out the other end the same way it went in, so I don't bother. So I'll just hatch some of the flies and chuck those in, and they can chase those around as well.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense. I even think some of the lizards struggled to digest it properly, to be honest, as well. I've had plenty of beardies that I've seen through the shop and that poop it out the same as it went in. So,
I gave some to my blue tongues the other day, and it rarely digests the way it should. I did actually see something recently, may have been posted on one of the beardie groups. So it's always been said that the soldier larvae doesn't need dusting because of the calcium phosphorus content is correct. But there's a study of some sort, but most of the calcium content is actually in sort of, the chitin or the outside layer, which isn't actually digested all that well.
Yep.
So our recommendation is actually to still dust them. So that, if it's not being digested, great. I think it's good as a part of a diet, but if it's not being digested, then I'd rather give them the flies. So
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
But,
have you ever tried like the wingless fruit flies and stuff for your smaller frogs?
Yeah, I've done. I do them as well when I'm got baby when for froglets.
Yeah.
So just as something else other than like the pinheads and that sort of thing. I've also got an aphid. From the roses outside when I've had tiny, tiny little froglets. They don't love them, but they will eat them. Also, some of your tiny frog, like your phallets when they come out, some of your dainties even, they morph so small, they can eat spring. They'll happily eat springtails for a day or two.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So I have massive amount of isopods because I use clean-up crew, obviously, so I've got multiple isopod colonies. But I don't feed them. Like some of them might snack on them in the enclosures, but I don't feed them as a food source.
Yeah.
But I've watched my whistling tree frogs, and there'll be a couple of days where I'll try and limit their food because sometimes they get a bit – whistling tree frogs can get a little chunky. and it took me a little while when I first had them to realise that, I was cutting their food down and they're getting bigger and bigger, and then one day I went, hang on a minute – and I went searching and they just about cleaned up every isopod they could find. I've got photos of this whistling tree frog girl, and she looked like her head was like a pimple on a pumpkin. She had rolls coming under her arms, and you know, I dropped their food right down, and I could not. I'm like, well, she, I mean, I can understand when they're gravid, they get, but she didn't even look gravid; she just looked fat. And yeah, they just decimated the isopod colony that was in there. And there's leaf litter, there's everything. So they did a pretty good job, but. Yeah, the smallest frog species will snack on the isopods, but the big frogs don't even notice them. So, yeah. Like, not in the slightest. Okay. But I'm trying to think if anything else I feed. No, just silkworms are really good in season. So, I need to get better at raising them. I did keep some of the adult silkworms from last season, and they turned into moths, and I got all the eggs, and I was going to Google what I was supposed to do with them after that. And I spent, you know, 15 hours on the road for work and each day, and it just, I've still got a tub up on top of the rack, and I'm not quite entirely sure what to do with them.
Oh, that's so too funny. Yeah, it'd be kind of cool to be have some of those, like, soft-bodied, you know, worms or caterpillars or something like that, like, as a food source all year, you know, like that's... Yeah, it'd be nice to be able to have that. You see a lot of the guys in the US that have those hornworms or whatever. And,
I think that's mental for those too.
Mm. Yeah.
And really good if you've got something that's a bit dehydrated, like some diabetes or something that, you know, oh, no, I can't possibly eat my greens and or drink water. it'd be great. So.
Yeah. Big hit of fiber for them and everything. It'd be perfect. Yeah,
get everything going again. So, oh, Richard, give it a rest.
He sounds good.
Oh, that name's so fitting.
Yeah.
He started calling it, he hit puberty about 9 months. And I mean, that's him quiet for what he was for about 4 days straight. Just, it was just, and it got to the point it was barking like a dog. And, my son getting to the point he was coming out and like squirting him with the spray bottle, or he'd like get him and he'd like put him down in the water because he'd stopped for a minute. There's videos on my page actually of some of the juvenile white-lipped males fighting and wrestling in the water section because they're fighting over territory and the girls.
Yeah,
brutal. Like they really are trying to drown each other. Yeah, they were wild. So I mean, I'd separate them for a while and they went into timeout and. Put them back in, and I had four males. Did sell one of the males, and once just taking one out just calmed everything down. And Richard, you know, the king of his mountain now, and no one really messes with him, and he's happy now. So he's not. So it was wild to see it though. I hadn't seen it before. I mean, I know it happens, but Yeah, I just hadn't seen it before, and they're into it. So, like, WWE style. They're taking branches and, like, dunking into the water, and, yeah, it was crazy.
Like kid boys playing in the pool.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Dunking the hell out of each other. So.
Yeah. That sounds familiar.
Yeah, definitely. But no one else. Something like that. So,
on your enclosures, do you have any like misting systems or anything set up? Like, have you, or are you just all manual?
No, I'm pretty much manual. I'm setting up misting systems for like the rainforest dragons and stuff, but I don't on the. So what I do, the green tree frogs require surprisingly low humidity in captivity. So all my bioactive tanks naturally during the day sit between 40% and 50%, which is what you want, which is perfect for a green tree frog.
Yeah.
Other species, you know, my mags, red eyes, dainties, they're all happy with higher, but because I've got other than the babies, I've got like 17 adult green tree frogs. And if the humidity in them gets a little bit high, you start getting bacterial infections. So I keep them pretty low. Because I've got so many tanks, I've got a lot with water sections, their humidity stays really good. I've got rain chambers if I need it for certain species for breeding, you know, like your mags, your green trees. The red eyes generally need a chamber too. So I'll put them in that, but they only go into it sort of a few days at a time and then they go back in. I really don't keep anything in high humidity because, you know, especially your tree frogs, thinking about during the day, you know, your parents are in bark in the trees, everything else is pretty much up in the canopies, which is actually pretty dry up there. They come down to the water when they need moisture, breeding, that sort of thing. But during the day, they're not, well, other than the bell frogs that like to sit in the water, but all your tree frogs generally sit up higher and drier in the canopies. So yeah. I have a lot of pothos. I love pothos for frog tanks. It grows well. You can't kill the stuff. And the frogs love the leaves. So I sort of grow it across the top that mimics a tree canopy. Mm-hmm. Under the lights, most of the time the frogs sleep on that, you know, having a bit of a bask. And then at nighttime, lights go off. Humidity naturally spikes at nighttime anyway. They'll all come down to the water. And, yeah, I find it just keeps everyone pretty healthy. So, and if I can spray a tank. But with the bioactive, I tend to really only groundwater.
Yeah.
Maybe once or twice a week. I'll spray if, you know, leaves get dirty because, you know, frogs pee and poo on them, a bit of calcium, that sort of stuff. I'll give the leaves a bit of spray with the nozzle to clean them off. But, yeah, the only time I really need to spray a tank is if, you know, a couple of little orchids or an air plant or something needs a water. But, there, that's pretty much it. So.
Oh, nice. Nice and simple then.
Yeah.
Oh, sometimes simple just makes it easy, you know, like it's that old saying, keep it simple, stupid. Like it's not always a bad thing to just be a little bit more hands-on. I think I'm just in the lazy category where I kind of like things automated so I don't have to be so hands-on. But, you know, then that also leaves room for error. So
that's right.
You know.
But, I mean, I've got, you know, when you I have a pretty thick layer, leaf litter layer, so the soil doesn't dry out too much anyway, so the plants don't need a lot of water. So the frogs that have bowls, sometimes I'll just tip the water out. If it's not too dirty, I'll just tip it out in there, take it out, wash it, refill it. Even that's enough of a water. The water section ones, I use a bacterium product in all my water. Stability. Dimax does one as well called Instant Bacterium. Mm-hmm. Every single water change, water bowl, water that I add, my tadpoles, everything, they all get this water, this biological addition to it. Since I was doing that, plants, I use it for everything, spraying, watering, the lot. Frog waters don't get as slimy. My water sections, I don't ever change water. I just top it up now. They've got a lot of plant, so plant filter and the product. But, I use that when I'm watering the plants, everything. So I just tip out the bowls that's already got it in there, chuck some water on the plants, top up some leaf litter, done. So,
yeah.
Got to make it easier to have this number.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. If once you start to get the, you know, a bit of a system going, it makes things a little bit easier.
Because, you know, the 12-year-old son, you know, wonderful help if none of his friends are online or he's not waiting, you know, for a box or something like that. He'll come out and help me with everything. But yeah, that video call happens. Yeah, he's gone. So, rely on having help. So.
So with the frogs, what type of stuff are you doing to prepare for like the breeding season?
Look, coming into winter, I make sure everyone's got pretty good weight on them.
Yeah.
Which because I feed quite a range, everyone does anyway. But I just make sure, everyone's check on everyone's body condition. Your boys can lose a bit of weight over summer, especially. If they've been calling or trying to get the girls, that sort of thing. So some of the boys need a little bit extra food. The girls, because we had a pretty good season, everything wanted to spawn, so I removed a few water sections just to try and give the girls a break. The white lips every 3 weeks, the parents every 3 weeks, dainties were going. There was, you know, everything was just, there was too much. So I removed some water sections, didn't stop the white lips, they just go in the bowl, they don't care. So some of the girls that did spawn a few extra times made sure they get extra, keep everyone warm. But then, yeah, coming into winter, we'll just slowly, you know, timing of the lights drops down. I will, not that they agree, but I will drop down how often some of the species are fed, especially the bigger ones. You know, try and give them, you know, at least a day in between feeds, a couple would be better for them, just to mimic more what they'd find out in the wild. There's going to be less insects with the cold, that sort of thing. Don't know if that's going to work with the green trees and the mags because they get a little hangry. And probably straight away into keeping them, I realised that if I dropped down a feeder size, I could feed them a bit more regularly without having obesity problems, but it just kept them a little happier. Weren't going frantic and climbing the grass after, you know, one day going, oh, my God, I'm starving. So, yeah, I dropped them down to, like, medium crickets. That way they could, you know, they were still getting the same sort of food intake, and I wasn't going to run into them getting, you know, hugely obese, and they thought they were getting fed every day, and that worked well. So they don't love winter when I try and tell them that it's diet time. So we'll see how that goes. But, yeah, cutting down daylight hours, a little bit less food, trying to mimic, you know, a little bit of nature. We'll see how it goes.
So. Yeah. And what are you doing with the spawn once you've, like, once they've, like, laid the eggs and all that? Are you leaving it in the tank? Are you taking it out and separating it or?
No, well, at the moment, so, yeah, obviously Australia's, yes, frogs are gaining in popularity, but we just don't have that kind of market. Yes. Probably 95% of my spawn gets removed as soon as it's laid and it gets discarded.
Yeah.
Just because it's, I think it's irresponsible. You know, I could have, you know, between the species I have, I could end up into the hundreds of thousands if I, you know, no one can afford that many crickets. So,
yeah, that's right.
So certain species like, you know, your Philocroa, your red eyes, I'll let a full, like a full spawn of the dainties, just one, those I'll raise. Everything else I'll sort of remove a section, and I'll raise that and I discard the rest.
Yeah.
Just to try and sort of limit numbers. So, like, you know, say the white lips, you know, I'd try and sort of set aside between sort of try and average sort of 20 to 50 maybe eggs, because obviously not everything's might not be fertile. Some, you know, you do have a few issues that can pop up with tadpoles. You know, a couple are always sort of designed as food to get eaten. Yep. Yeah, I just try and keep a little bit from most. Some species, I don't keep any. You know, like the albino spotted marsh frogs. Yeah, you can't find homes. They look like raw chicken. I wouldn't. Things. But I do believe that, yeah, even any of the species, the female frogs, you know, you'll see how big they can get when they get grabbed. I think for their health, they need to be allowed to spawn.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're egg binding in certain species, you can run into problems with the frogs too. So, you know, I've got a bunch of green tree frog girls that are absolutely huge, and I'll pop them into the rain chamber next season, hopefully let them offload. But, yeah, again, all gets going to have to be discarded. So
yeah,
it's the downside to managing having this number of frogs and, you know, males and females in together and that sort of thing. But, yeah, it's got to be a bit more responsible about it. And, you know, yeah. I don't sort of tip it down the toilet, but, yeah, I just take them straight out. They go out in the grass and the magpie families see me coming and they all race over. So it kind of goes back to, but that's within, you know, sort of hours of being laid. They're still eggs. They're not larvae yet, anything like that. But, yeah, that is, you know, the reality of it, and that's kind of what you've got to do. So,
yeah.
That's responsible pet keeping at the end of the day. Exactly. It's the same as, you know, that I've heard plenty of people that breed bearded dragons or something. Nowadays there's a bit of a push into, okay, I'm going to have, you know, she's potentially going to lay 4 clutches this year. I'll keep maybe half of one clutch because I just want to raise like 15 dragons or something, you know. Yeah. So it's just that kind of, instead of putting 100 out into the world, not caring for them properly as hatchlings or whatever, or not being able to afford the upkeep and all the rest of it. That is putting better animals out there in a smaller quantity. And
100% you know, agree.
You're going to end up with happier pet owners. You're going to end up with, you know, more customers that will come back next year if they want more animals or something like that. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's the right decision.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You know, and I think you and that's sort of on us, you know, especially when keepers get into larger collections. And, yeah, I think health reasons, a lot of these breeding animals do need to be bred. But, yeah, eggs can be put into a freezer, you know, tadpole eggs can go out onto the out to the magpies. It's, you know, I think there are better ways for us to manage having that number and not just keep breeding more and more and more. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah, not everything needs to hatch or live or
no.
Yeah. No. Yeah. You gotta think about the forever game with moving on those animals and that. And,
yeah. Oh, that's no, right. It's
very, very right.
You know, yeah, I live on acreage and I've got a big house and shared the studio, but it comes a point, you know, I can't keep, you know, 4,000 frogs from a season. Yeah. They're not going to get a level of care because I just physically am one person. I can't do it. I'm, you know, I'm pretty flat chat as it is. So, you know, it's not going to better my life. It's not going to better their life. So, yeah, better that, yeah, I just manage them responsibly and no one can afford that many crickets. So. No,
definitely not.
No, I don't know if you can keep up with me. So.
Not with that many mouths.
No.
Have you, by chance, have you looked into breeding your own crickets?
I have. And I've tried a couple of times. And I tried with like the little Chinese containers with the soil and the peat and everything and a little bit of mesh over it. And then I'd either wet them too much or they'd dry out or I wouldn't get them out in time. And it just. I could never manage it. So, and the number I go through, you know, I mean, at the moment when I've got froglets, I'm going through, what did I pick up? 6,000 to 9,000 crickets a week. So,
oh, wow.
About turning my 18 meter shed into a, you know, into something. Look, one of my monitor books, does have a really good, great little section in it, actually. About using the green florist foam that they use for flower arrangements.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's got a big section on that, how to have a reservoir and keep the moisture levels right, chuck them in an old chest freezer and cut out a hole for lights, and that looks great. And I'd love to do it, but I know that I'm just not going to have the time. I'll forget about it. All the pinheads will get eaten, something. I'd rather raise more woodies, to be honest. So
yeah, no, fair enough.
Yeah,
yeah. I won't say that I'm an expert by any means, but I've definitely found a pretty good way to kind of raise a reasonable amount with minimal effort.
Oh, okay, cool.
Should I say so? You know, just kind of, I went down a rabbit hole for ages just watching like all these guys in the US breeding crickets and stuff in like factories, like not just like a little setup or whatever. And I was just trying to like, okay, what are they doing that I can then put into a 50 liter tub worth of pinheads and see how far I can get raising them and that. And like even now, like my crickets completely, like I went off it for a couple of weeks there or whatever. And, you know, things ensue. And then all of a sudden I got back into it and I bought like two boxes or three boxes of large crickets from the pet shop that were all like pretty like prime chirping. And I ended up with about, I'm going to say 5,000 pinheads out of like a week's worth of work with them, which was just replacing egg containers like every couple of days. I've just been raising those up now. But, yeah, I kind of set them up so I can neglect them. But they'll live.
That's up my alley.
yeah. I'm happy to talk further about that. I don't want to put it out there just in case I give somebody the wrong idea and then all of a sudden they're like I don't want to have like somebody go, no, that didn't work for me, and then all of a sudden they're down my throat. So yeah, so I'm happy to talk through some ideas if you just want to give it a crack one day or whatever.
Oh, that I can't do it, so you know, I could breed and raise about everything else I've ever tried. So
I'll definitely say that Frizy was pretty instrumental with me having success. And one of the biggest things that he taught me was the fact that humidity for like the first 10 days in the pinheads is crucial. So they want higher humidity while they're kind of going through that first molt or two as they're kind of getting into a bit of more of a solid cricket. Because that's where I was going wrong, is I was pulling them too early and kind of letting them dry out, and I was losing 50% of them.
Yeah.
But then once he told me that, that kind of got me over the line with more consistent numbers.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I've got a big tub at the moment that says unsorted woodies because I need to do more sorting with the holes and the buckets and all that sort of stuff, and that's just chaos. So I pretty much sit there and try and tap out the sizes, feed out the big ones and bring it back and tip all the babies back in.
That's what I do.
Man, I take a jar out, I put it with a carrot in the bottom of it, I put it in the woody container, and I come back like 2 hours later, I got a jar full of woodies, and I just distribute sizes to everybody. I just run around and I go, everyone's getting larges. Okay, you're all getting larges. Okay, we're down to mediums. All right, you guys are getting this.
Yeah, I did that with
work through my jar.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still haven't done that yet.
All the big ones get theirs, and then I get to the smaller ones, and then but then the tiny itty bitty baby is like, yeah, sorry guys, you need to go grow up a bit more. Don't worry about your calcium power. You'll walk it off.
Yeah. I just found that was the best for, because I get horrible sneezing fits and stuff with them. So I get over wearing masks and that. And I used to, bang them out and, frass would be going everywhere and that while I was trying to collect them. And, a little bit of jar, a little bit of petroleum jelly around the top and a slice of carrot in there after they haven't had fresh food for a couple of days and they go bonkers for it. Yeah.
Cool.
Easy woody catch.
Nice. Pick them off the walls with my hand and they tickle, and it's just,
I end up with, if I do that, I'll have like rashes all up my arms and all sorts of.
Yes, I don't have that yet, but I know I've read other keepers that can develop it over time. I have had a bit of a cough, but I'm a smoker, so that's not surprising. I do worry about chucking my hands in there always, and because I'm actually allergic to the horses and like the horse feed especially. So I wouldn't be surprised if I did develop something to them. So I do need to work out a better way of working with the woodies that I'm not so hands-on. So
that might be the go.
I haven't thought about like a how you kind of have like those series of buckets with different holes for like sorting them and the sizes. Like I was even thinking, I was like, you could almost do like my carrot jar trick, but like put a lid on and then just drill different size holes in the lids. Bloody oath.
Oh, I like that idea. I might try that.
Yeah, that'll work too.
What's the worst thing that happens? You have a peanut butter jar kicking around or something like that you can just clean out and give that a crack, and then all of a sudden you've got all your smalls, you got this, you got that.
I've got a bunch.
I mean, obviously you will end up with the big stuff and the small stuff in the big hole jar, but.
Yeah, at least the small ones.
If you just want to collect the small ones or something.
Just put that in. I might give that a crack. I've got a bunch of those little white buckets you get from Bunnings because I bought lots in different sizes for all the different tile pointing and bits and pieces for backgrounds. So I've got a few of the little ones. So I might go and chuck some holes in some of the lids and pop those. See if that that works. They can sort themselves out. Excellent.
Let me know if it works. It's just an idea. I mean, in theory it makes sense, but, you never know until you do it, so.
I might give that a crack. So,
well, speaking about tile pointing, so I'm assuming then you make a lot of your own backgrounds and decor and stuff for your enclosures?
Yeah. I actually really enjoy doing it. At the moment I've got probably a few too many on the go in different stages, as we all do. And, look, I watch the same. You get on YouTube and, like you've had other guests say, there's loads of American content and it's dry lock this and, I'm not spending dry lock at Amazon. So, and eventually I discovered between you and Coops and a few other Aussie guys, led me the tile pointing, which I really like. It's easy. I do have a couple of backgrounds I've made that I've mucked up in that because I've done ledges or crevices, like my little Fimbria one, I've done all these little vertical crevices and cliffs and everything for them. And there must be a spot that I haven't gotten the layering of tile pointing deep enough. And there's now a little pile of green foam looking sand burrowed in and made itself at home. So that's going to have to be ripped out and started again. And I've got that in my Aki as well. There's a spot just under a ledge and where there's a branch sort of foamed in as well. So it's a really awkward spot, and I did think that I got enough in there, obviously hadn't. And his is like a 6x3x3 enclosure.
Oh, man.
So that's that. I'm just ignoring that for the time being. I can't even deal with that at the moment. I just vacuum up the foam. Look, I did try. I really enjoy watching some of the videos put out by the Natural Herb Keeper. And so I tried to do the grout because I just wanted to try everything. And yeah. I started, and I do not have the patience for that. Like, not even a little bit. I did get one layer done and started doing stuff, and it's now got two layers of tile pointing over the top.
Yeah. It's definitely an art to it, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I love the look of it, but it just wasn't for me. So I let it dry and whacked a couple of coats of tile pointing over it and called it a day. So
I suppose in some sense – oh, sorry.
No, I was just saying, I've got to chuck out grout and all the rest of it.
I think for me, I was always in a rush to, like, you know, get a coat on and go to bed or something like that. So I wasn't putting a coat of grout on, wait an hour or two, then come back and start scratching things into it. But, oh, man, kudos where kudos is due. Like, those grout backgrounds that people are doing are insane. Like, they're definitely
They're amazing. Like,
top tier.
Yeah. And I enjoy watching the video of them doing it too. Mm. I find that
it's quite therapeutic.
It is. If you're watching it, for me doing it, no.
Yeah, not same here.
Just frustration. But that's a little bit ADHD. That's more my issues. So, but yeah, I enjoy watching it and the carving and the way that they can put that detail into it. Oh, they're beautiful and they look amazing. It just wasn't for me. So I just stick with the tile pointing. And I mix up different colours with oxides. Like, I've got all the colours of the tile pointing. So I've got sand, the terracotta, the charcoal, or the slate or charcoal, it's called, one of them. One's a greyish sort of colour. And then I add different oxides to change colours around. And I'm just about, I was watching someone, it might have been that really cool grout one for the beardy, and the bit of acrylic paint in like a spray bottle to sort of give it a bit of a dribble over, or a little bit of definition. So I'm going to try that on my next one. Because I'm doing two new backgrounds for some children's pythons to move up into 4x2s. So I've got the sort of ledge, and I've made all little caves into it for them, as like a ledge as well, but I've done some little pockets and caves in it for them, so they can go and sort of hide in those as well. So I'm going to use a bit of the acrylic paint and the water and the spray bottle and sort of give it a bit of, see how that works on it. I like trying new things. It doesn't always work, but I like trying.
if I could give you one tip with the spray bottle on the tile pointing in particular, grout soaks it up really easily, whereas the tile pointing, it tends to maybe run a little bit further off it. So generally with the tile pointing, you just put maybe a little bit more paint in there than what you think you need, so it sits a bit better. So you're still making it very wet, but just maybe just a little bit more than what you would think you need, because otherwise, it tends to run off.
Would there be a difference with the tile pointing if you sprayed it before the tile point, like when the tile pointing was sort of still wet compared to dry?
Oh, yeah, I never really thought about doing it that way. I'd give it a crack. I mean, I'd imagine it would probably adhere to it a little bit easier, potentially.
I might try. I might test it out. So see about spraying it like while it's drying and see. I mean, it might. Yeah, I don't know. I'll give it a try. So
Yeah. I like the old old toothbrush or an old brush or something, and sometimes you can just like speckle bits of paint and stuff over them as well. That can sometimes give a cool little effect.
Yeah, I got some of the big like at Bunnings, like the big children's tubs of the acrylic paint. So I got some like reds and yellows and whites and blacks, so I can sort of mix up some colours to little ones.
Who was that?
I think that actually might be my new Gillens.
I was going to say, I didn't recognise that call.
No, the Centralians.
Yeah.
Hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah, I thought they, I mean, I'm surprised. They're, because I hadn't sort of seen, they're only about as big as some of my parents. They're really cute. They're such cute frogs. But yeah, I hadn't sort of, everything I'd read was that they're quite, you know, they're so similar to a green tree frog that their call was quite similar. That's nothing like a green tree frog. So.
No.
No.
That was pretty.
Yeah, that's unique. So when you, like, before you start, like, your habitats and stuff, do you actually do a bit of research on the natural habitat of the animal before you start the build?
Yep. So straight to iNaturalist usually. There's also loads of photos on Flickr. You can search that really well. But, yeah, iNaturalist, Flickr, and then I'll just sort of Google and then look for, you know, photos of them taken out in the wild. Unfortunately, a lot of the times you've got to sort of find their range and then go and look for photos without the frogs because everyone zooms in on the frogs.
Yeah.
And you don't get much information. So then you've got to jump into Google, work out where everything is, start Googling, you know, weird and wonderful places and trying to sort of or tap in, you know, native plants for that area. Rainfall, I look at sort of average rainfall for some of these areas because that might sort of indicate whether they have water sections or not, what humidity that they can deal with. Some of my species I'm trying to create more of a biotope. So like the phallax and the bicolors, that's going to be a lot easier for finding, you know, native reeds, rushes, sedge plants, that sort of thing. Same with the marsh frogs. There's a lot of great bog sort of natives, ground covers, that sort of stuff. Eventually I'd like to get into more biotope style for some of the other species, but for the ease of a lot of them, it's pothos, dragon's tail, you know, mini monsteras, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So just because it grows so easily. I haven't bought a plant in a long time, so I just might take cuttings. And I have never-ending – I have friends come over and go, here, you know, I've just had to trim a tank. Take some pothos, you know. People home with, like, shopping bags full of cuttings because otherwise it goes in my green bin because I'll keep a whole lot of it. And I've got houseplants of the stuff. They're in my office, the bathroom, like they're everywhere. But it's getting – I'm in a rental and I can't have it growing up the walls. So,
yeah. I actually noticed one of my monsteras is like I've got it on top of a cabinet. This is just like randomly, not even in an enclosure, but it kind of like hit the wall next to it and now it's starting to make its way to the roof. And I'm like, I mean, I'm got a mortgage on this place, so it's not so bad, but at the same time I'm like, how long do I leave this for? Like, when is it going to start causing damage, you know? But I'm kind of just watching it go. I'm like, this is cool.
They're pretty strong. I mean, some of my I've got a big one of my other green tree frog tanks is also a 90 centimeter by 90 Exoterra, and because I was in a bit of a hurry, I just used the existing Exoterra foam background and I chucked on a few PVC pipe hides with expanding foam and whacked tile pointing over the top, chucked it in. But it's got massive air roots from the pothos all growing into it. It's actually starting to look really cool because, you know, some of those really big rainforest plants with all the big roots that come out. So it's starting to look like that and it's just all these air roots embedding into the grey foam background. It's actually quite a cool effect. It's never coming out of that foam. Home now. But they're pretty strong and like some of those air roots are a good 5-6 mil across, so they could do some interesting damage to your wall.
So, yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, I might have a bit of a look at that tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's only like not even a foot's grown onto it yet. And it's only a small plant, but still, yeah, if it starts getting those big leaves on it.
If it starts getting the big ones, it might be they like ripping to things. So.
Yeah. We've actually got this pothos that's at the fish shop that I kind of still work at occasionally. And I originally, probably about 3 years ago, I popped it in the top of this fish tank. It's like a 40-litre fish tank, so nothing huge. And it started growing and, you know, spreading everywhere over the cabinets and that. And my boss was like, oh, that's really cool. And I was like, and we had like a power cord coming down to this fish tank from the roof. And I was like, yeah, we should chase it up to the roof and just do like hangers the whole way along the roof. Now there's like maybe, I'm going to say a good dozen, kind of like 6 to 8 meter strands of this stuff hanging across the roof, like all still going from this little 40 liter fish tank. It must have the cleanest water in this tank because I swear a water change has like never been done on it, and it's just living off this pothos is just living off the fish poo in the water. But it's pretty cool when you walk in and you see these big, huge leaves too growing out of the.
Just feel like walking around a little jungle. That'd be perfect. That's what I want my house to be.
It's pretty cool.
That'd look awesome.
I know we kind of touched on feeders and that. Did we touch on what supplements you use to coat your feeders in? Are you just doing calcium powder? Or are you doing any vitamins or anything as well?
Yeah. So I rotate. I've been using the Arcadia Earth Pro range for a little while.
Okay.
Yeah. So I use the. I'll have to go get them. I use their sort of their little chart. Not exactly because I don't dust for all the frogs as often as what they're sort of dusting for everything. So I'll do, calcium for a couple of feeds. I'll do like spread out and rotated, but, the calcium, the multivitamins. But I also rotate actual brands. I don't just stick with one brand. Because I think, none of them are all created equal or the same. There's going to be different profiles in them. So, I've got one calcium supplement that's got D3. Even though I've got the UVB probably maybe once every fortnight to 3 weeks, everyone will get something with the D3. Just in case, cause I do have, look, I've got a lot of species that'll come out and bask. I've got some that will, cryptic bask, and I've got others that will never, like your ground frogs that just don't come out. So just as an in case, and we just don't really know enough yet, I will just, it pretty much comes to like once a month, they'll all get a dusting with a calcium product that also has D3. There's some species I don't, so the red eyes get, their dusting schedule is probably a quarter of everyone else's. Red eyes can be quite sensitive to supplements. There can be kidney issues, fluid retention, that sort of stuff. I haven't experienced it myself, but with making contacts and having mentors with other breeders, that's, other experienced red-eye breeders have always said just limit their supplementation. So they get a lot less, but, everything else. I just, once I'll rotate brands, sort of over the space of not, there's no set schedule to it. I don't go, right, this week we're doing Arcadia, this week we're doing Pisces, this week we're doing, Reptile, whichever brand. I've got probably about 5 or 6 of them there. Because I do rotate, obviously I don't use all of it because I do throw them out after a certain amount of time. And then just buy fresh ones. So, because I'm not great about putting them away in a cold, dark cupboard and stuff. So I've got this little, I got it from my mum, one of those little IKEA wooden trolleys that's got some cupboards on it. With top bench. I have that in my frog room and that's my little prep area. And half the time if I'm running around trying to feed frogs at 3 o'clock in the morning before going to the airport, I'll leave a bag open and I won't get home till late that night. So I don't keep them long. I just chuck them and replace them. So.
Oh, cool. Oh, that's good. I've got one final question for you myself. If Jason's got anything else, he can rattle it off too. But just before we close anything out here, I think this is one that's probably pretty up Jason's alley as well, but do you have any sort of like recommended frog literature books as far as, you know, husbandry or care guides or anything go that you're kind of like your go-to books?
There is one. Hang on, I'm going to have to go. You have to come for a walk. <'Cause> I can't remember. Hi, Richard. Hi.
Oh, that's the best name for a frog.
It's just kind of funny too because it's like a double meaning. It's,
yeah. A few people probably cottoned onto it.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good stack.
I like books.
Same.
I don't think they're all here because I think I've been reading some. There's probably one on my desk. It's probably one over on the sofa. There'll be some. Most of these are just sort of field guides to frogs, that sort of thing. Oh, that one's basic. Oh, that's my new monitor book. That's really cool.
What book's that?
A guide to the second edition of the Guide to Australian Monitors in Captivity. Yeah.
Danny Brown.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty. And it's all nice and new and shiny, so I touch it. before I show you a care guide, I'll show you too much stuff on my desk. This is what we call the Bible.
I don't have that one. I need to get that. Yeah. It's so expensive.
Yeah. And it's a beast. It's heavy. Like, you know, I need two arms to lift it. But it is, we bought the Bible. So just for identification, tadpoles, information, you cannot beat this book. But, yeah.
Just for our listeners at home, are you able to tell us the title of that book?
Tadpoles and Frogs of Australia. It's the second edition and it's Marian Ancis's book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been eyeing that one off for a couple of years, I think.
Now. Yeah, same.
When I found it and was like, and was able to buy it, I was very excited. Whenever I'm sort of out, because I do a lot of the Frog ID recordings when I go out places, cool. Home, or if I go out with my son and we go looking for tadpoles, every time I'm trying to ID something, I come to this book.
So. Yeah.
The illustrations, the information, it's beautiful. Probably
I might have to do that soon.
Most of these are all, just sort of
field guides.
Stuff. That's an awesome book too. I don't know if you can see it. Wait, where's my camera?
Oh, that HS one.
Yeah. Really pretty lizards. All right, so probably I just referred this one. It's one of Scott's books.
Yeah. He wrote, in the Danny Brown series, that one. Yeah. That's a good one. Got
the best information. I mean, it's for keeping frogs. That would be one I would recommend people to get. It's got a really good little section on it's got a bit of everything. You know, it's actually probably one of the most comprehensive ones that we've got for in Australia.
Definitely.
Species list, really good sizes for enclosures, a little bit bigger than what a lot of people recommend, which is great because bigger is always better. UVB for everything, which I absolutely 100% agree with and can't stress enough to people for frogs. I really like this book just for some of the things. It's just common sense. And it's got little pretty pictures of blue mountains and stuff. for Australian, that is the book I recommend people to get. So, and it covers, covers some of the medical stuff, a little bit of chytrid because that's a big problem here in Australia. It touches on it, but it's enough that, people can get started and can go and find out more and, find out some info. But, there's a disease check. There's some really good information. So, especially for me, it's a good book. So,
yeah, definitely.
If my beast of a care guide that was supposed to start off as something to have as sheets for the expo ever gets finished, it's getting there, but I'm doing like a care guide with little sections for space, just more of a basic one, but just like a shopping list, because everyone asks me, you know, what size tank, you know, this and that, something that I can give out as a care sheet when I'm selling frogs at expos, that sort of thing. And I'm also setting up a bioactive guide for new keepers that I can also give them when it's like a little care package sort of thing, information package when they buy frogs from me at expos, just to send them home with something to sort of get started on and look at in their own time. But a little shopping list. Oh, an adult cricket somewhere. Wild here. So I'm doing that at the moment just so I can give, you know, a little PDF printout just to send people home with something from the expos. With they got their little froggy in their hand, they got some info, they've got a chance to go home and sort of, you know, give them both a chance of having a really good relationship and a good setup. So,
yeah, that's excellent.
That's a brilliant idea, really. Yeah. I think more people should probably maybe consider that as an option. You know, if you're religiously breeding a species of animal, then, you know, people are buying it. Not a horrible idea.
Well, see, with the dogs, because I bred and showed whippets, and we always had a puppy pack. But in that puppy pack was the information. It was everything, you know, feeding charts, and there weren't what they'd been fed, what they'd been wormed, links to where they could find the correct, you know, martingale's coats, like just everything that, you know, a bit of the on the breed and the species for information. And I'd get them in, you know, a big proper folder with plastic sleeves, and they'd get all the paperwork in there, and I'd print off, you know, breed history and care guides and what to feed, when, all that sort of stuff, just to get people started. I'm like, well, it's really not any different from with me doing sending someone home with a frog. So
they're
going to outlive the dogs that I used to breed. You know, some of these frogs are easily going to hit 20 years. So I want to set up right from the start.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, 100%. Well, this has been brilliant. Have you guys got anything else that you want to touch on?
I'm good.
No, I'm good.
Well, what I'll definitely say is, Michaela, if you want to throw out like where people can contact you if they want to purchase any frogs, or if they just want to talk frogs with you or ask any questions, have you got your social media and that kind of across the board?
Yeah, I do. So Instagram, Facebook page is all under the Max Frog Army. That's currently is going to change because we've been working on a name that I can actually register and have as the business and when I open the store and everything, because I can't have frog or army in the business name apparently in New South Wales. So the YouTube channel will launch as Max Herps and Reptiles. But, yeah, at the moment, all the frog stuff, it's all Max Frog Army. I'm trying to get the hang of Insta a bit more. I'm kind of new to that side of it. I'm getting there. Facebook's easier for me, so I'm on that. But, yeah, people can contact me on that, anytime. So,
excellent.
So,
this has been brilliant. Hopefully this is kind of like getting people excited for Australian frogs, because I don't think there's enough hobbyists out there that are enjoying these little buggers.
Definitely.
Such amazing frogs. I talk to anyone about frogs. They don't have to buy frogs from me or anything like that. If they just want to say, hey, how do I make a substrate, or what plants can I plant, I will totally answer like any sort of question relating to frogs or bioactive anytime.
Brilliant.
That's
good. Alrighty, guys. Well, we'll wrap up the show here, but we'd like to say a massive thank you to Eric and Owen and the rest of the MPR crew for having us. If you'd like to contact them, it's best to find them at moreliapythonradio.com and email them at info@moreliapythonradio.com. Make sure to follow the MPR network on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. As far as contacting us and our social media platforms, you can email us at australianherpticulture@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram as well. Make sure to check out our Teespring store for podcast merch. The link is on the Facebook page. To see more of what Jason is doing, make sure to follow him on Facebook and Instagram at The Gecko Effect. And for myself, you can find me on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, Patreon, and Teespring under Beats of Scaly Beasts. We hope to have you back next time for another episode of the Australian Herpticulture Podcast. Good night, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.